a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
And welcome. It is so great to have you with us today as we get ready to dive into the life of C.S. Lewis. We're excited about this. I know many of our listeners are big C.S. Lewis fans. Perhaps you're one of them. One of the first books I think I ever read on apologetics was Mere Christianity. And love, just absolutely love the Chronicles of Narnia. I've read it to my kids. In fact, I think I first read it to my kids when my son was 5 or 6 and my daughter was 4. And they actually sat with just rapt attention as we went through the entire series and loved every moment of it. And now that they're a little bit older, they understand some of the spiritual ramifications of Chronicles of Narnia. And we'll be unpacking that a bit with our guest, who's an expert on C.S. Lewis, as we find out more about his life and his spiritual journey. So stick with us for that. We want to invite you to give us a call if you would like to get entered into a drawing for a copy of one of the books we're going to be talking about today, which, again, it's called A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis by Devin Brown, our guest. And if you call us this hour at 877-93-FAITH, give us your contact info. At the end of the hour, we will have that drawing for 3 copies of A Life Observed. So by all means, and if you have any questions, too, during the hour, if you're a C.S. Lewis fan, want to know more about his life and his spiritual journey, we'd invite you to call us with any questions that you might have, 877-93-FAITH. Well, as you know, each week, as a psychologist, I kind of like to dive into some of the things that have come out in the news regarding families or faith and culture. And I found a story that really troubled me about childhood obesity in the U.S. You probably have heard that we've got a significant issue with that. It's been in the news quite a bit. But this new finding, this new study really shocked me because it turns out that 1 out of 8 children in the United States is obese when they enter kindergarten. And those numbers increase through the elementary school year. So 1 out of 8 kids in America, when they start kindergarten at what, age 5 or so, they're clinically obese. By the 8th grade, 1 in 5 kids in the U.S. is obese. Another 17% are overweight. That is just stunning. Because think of all the health problems these kids are at risk for. Type 2 diabetes, stroke, arthritis, heart disease, you just name it. And the research shows that obesity has more than doubled in children and tripled in teenagers since the 1980s. I was looking at this research. Solving Cunningham at Emory University's Medical School was the lead researcher. Dr. Cunningham recommends that obesity prevention efforts need to be focused on kids who are overweight when they are toddlers or preschoolers before the age of 5. He says we should target the children who are most susceptible to becoming obese during later childhood and adolescence. Just shocking to look at this. They followed data from 21,000 kindergartners as they aged all the way up until 8th grade, trying to provide a sample of kids in the United States. And they concluded, they considered that a child would be overweight if he or she was above the 85th percentile for weight, as calculated by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A child would be considered obese if they were above the 95th percentile for their age. Now, if your child is overweight, let me just recommend a great place to go for help, for advice. That's the American Academy of Pediatrics website for parents, which is healthychildren.org, healthychildren.org. Okay, that's kind of the bad news. Here's some great news on the faith front. I was so encouraged by this. You may know I love reporting on encouraging faith stories, and this one caught my eye. Last year, Approximately 10 million people around the world experience the good news of Jesus Christ by visiting a special website created by the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association. And of those, more than 2 million said they made a commitment to Christ after viewing the messages there. The website is peacewithgod.net, and it is part of the BGEA's Search for Jesus Internet Ministry. And what they do, I've checked it out this week, they use scripture, they use videos, they use live chat to share the gospel with anyone who visits the site. John Cass is the director of Internet Evangelism for the Billy Graham Association. He says these numbers are hard to fathom. John says, on a daily basis, I get the opportunity to read through transcripts of the chats taking place between visitors to our site and our trained volunteer counselors. And I can tell you that the world is being impacted for Christ. They've got, I think, about 300 volunteers there at the Billy Graham headquarters in Charlotte, North Carolina. And these are people anywhere from their 20s to their 80s, all walks of life, who have committed to give of their time to assist people who are looking for answers. And John Cass says they take the online interaction and make it a much more personal one-on-one experience. They chat with people, they guide them through a free online discipleship course, and they respond to spiritual questions by email. And if you want to check out this website for yourself, again, it's peacewithgod.net, peacewithgod.net. Something I know C.S. Lewis would have been proud of, to hear this great evangelistic effort on the part of the Billy Graham folks. Well, it's 10 minutes past the hour, and as we said, coming up next, we dive into the life and the spiritual legacy of C.S. Lewis with our guest, Devin Brown. Stick with us here on the Faith Radio Network.
The class clown. Who doesn't remember the one person in school who was always able to make everyone else crack up at the most inopportune times?
Here's Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
You know, it's my belief that boards of education assign at least one clown per class to make sure that school teachers earn every dollar of their salary. These skilled little disruptors are usually boys. They often have reading or other academic problems. They may be small in stature, though not always, and they'll do anything for a laugh. Their parents and teachers are usually unappreciative of their humor and may never recognize that behind the smiles and the laughter is the pain of inferiority. Humor is a classic response to feelings of pain and loneliness. That's why behind many successful comedians is a hurting little boy or girl. Jonathan Winter's parents were divorced when he was 7, and he used to cry alone because other children said he had no father. Joan Rivers jokes incessantly about her unattractiveness as a girl. She said she was such a dog her father had to throw a bone down the aisle to get her married. These comedians got their training during childhood using humor as a defense against childhood hurts. That's also the inspiration for the class clown. By making an enormous joke out of everything, he conceals the self-doubt that churns inside. If we understand that frame of reference, then, we should know how to help him cope with peace and tranquility in the classroom.
Hear more at MyFamilyTalk.com. MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
Hey, welcome back. Our phone number is 877-93-FAITH. If you want to touch base with us this hour, we'd love to hear from you. And as we mentioned, if you give us your contact info, we'll put you into a drawing for a copy of A Life Observed, a spiritual biography of C.S. Lewis, written by Devin Brown, who is our guest today. And let me tell you a little bit about Devin. He is a Lilly Scholar, professor of English at Asbury University in Kentucky, where he teaches courses on C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. He's written, taught, and lectured on C.S. Lewis extensively for more than 10 years, written a number of books related to Lewis, including Inside Narnia, and in 2008 he was invited to serve as a scholar in residence at the Kilns, Lewis's home in Oxford. And Devin, welcome to Faith Radio.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Now, a lot of our listeners are going to be very familiar with C.S. Lewis and his writings, but I'm guessing there are others who may not know much about the man or his work. So let me ask you, how did you first become interested in the life and the faith of Lewis, or Jack, as his friends called him?
Yeah, that's a great place to start. I mean, a lot of people today know Lewis really as the guy who wrote the books that those movies were based on, the Narnia movies. A lot of people only know him through those films. I grew up on the blue-collar south side of Chicago a number of years ago, let's say, before C.S. Lewis became a household name. And I'd never heard of him growing up. You mentioned you read the Chronicles of Narnia to your kids. I'd never heard of those books. My older brother went away to college and came home at Thanksgiving and throws a book on my bed. I'm a sophomore in high school, and he says, you should read this. And like all, you know, good younger brothers, I did what I was told. And I love this book. I read it in about one day, and I knew I'd never read anything like it before, and it was called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Back then, you know, there was no internet to search things on, so I went to the library and asked the librarian, you know, who's this author? Are there any other books by him? And as everybody in your audience, I'm sure, knows, yeah, there's six more in this series, and when you finish that, there's a space trilogy, there's a Screwtape Letters, and if you like a different kind of writing, he's got things like Mere Christianity and The Problem of Pain. So, yeah, I discovered him as a sophomore in high school. He became my favorite author. I'll just say this. I'm an English professor, and I do teach a class on Lewis now, but there was no classes to take on Lewis when I was going through college. So, you know, I studied him on my own, and as soon as I finished my dissertation and I could study what I wanted, I said, well, he's going to be my focus and has been ever since.
Mm. Obviously a fascinating man, and why don't we start by kind of diving into his biography. Tell us about his family of origin and his early life.
Yeah, I mean, people know him largely as this Oxford scholar, a member of the Inklings and a friend of J.R. Tolkien. And, of course, his house still stands outside just on the edge of Oxford. But he wasn't born there. He was born in Northern Ireland in Belfast and grew up right in the center of those, as they call them, the troubles between Catholics and Protestants, the terrible conflicts there. One reason, I think, that later in life he refused to become entrenched in the interdenominational clashes. Instead, he, you know, would go on to write Mere Christianity, a book that looks at the things that unite all Christians, not at the things that divide him. Anyway, he grew up there, grew up in a Christian home, was taken to the local church. Matter of fact, his grandfather's church, his grandfather on his mother's side, was a pastor in the Church of Ireland, which we would call the Anglican Church, or in America, the Episcopal Church. But he didn't have faith as a child. He went to Sunday school, and he was told what he should believe. He didn't have a real faith until he went off to boarding school. And then he did acquire a faith, and he calls himself in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, if people want to read more. He says, it was there at boarding school that I first became an effective believer. That childhood faith doesn't last for long. He drops it when he becomes a teenager, and he's an atheist, and a pretty serious one, you know, all through his teens and his 20s, gets a degree from Oxford. And so it was clear that he would always be a writer of some sort, because he loved books and was a very gifted writer. It wasn't always clear that he would be a Christian writer or even a Christian.
Now, let's go back to boarding school for a moment. Did he go off to a Christian boarding school? Was there a particular professor? Was it the readings that he did that first got him, as you said, to become an effective believer, even though, again, he lost his faith in adolescence? What happened in boarding school?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure that there was such a thing as Christian boarding schools back then. The English boarding school is this tradition where rich folks sent their kids at what to Americans seems like a very young age. Lewis had suffered the loss of his mother. His mom dies when he's nine. Mm-hmm. And he prays. He prays that she gets better. And then if you read his autobiography carefully, it seems like he prayed for her to come back to life after she was dead. Wow. And prayed in earnest, but he's very careful to say that he wouldn't call that a Christian prayer. He looked at God as some sort of genie in a bottle. And if he said the right words and produced the right emotion, then, like, you know, putting the quarters in the vending machine and pulling the right handle, he'd get the proper results. So he doesn't call himself a Christian in those early days. He goes to boarding school, and it's a bad boarding school. I mean, it's a boarding school right out of a Charles Dickens novel.
Oh, no.
And bad schools appear all throughout the Chronicles of Narnia. I mean, if you read kind of carefully, you see Edmund kind of started to go bad when he went to boarding school, and of course Eustace, who Edmund later calls a record stinker, goes to this terrible boarding school called Experiment House.
Yes. The open classroom concept.
Yeah, the open everything concept. They were big on bullies and not so good on learning anything. So he goes to this terrible boarding school in England, and of course that's where you, if you're a proper Northern Irish family, your sons have to go to an English school so that they get rid of that Northern Irish accent and they're around gentlemen. It's kind of a status thing. Anyway, part of what happened at this horrible boarding school was that he actually went to a church where, as he says, people actually believed the things they said they believed. And I don't want to be too hard on the church that he grew up in. You know, in life, we all can be exposed to the gospel, and if we're not ready to hear it, we just don't hear it.
Right.
And so for some reason, Lewis did not hear the gospel when he was a really young boy, but did hear it when he was about 10 or 11 off at this boarding school, and happened to go to this church where he recognized in the people that went there a genuine faith and aspired for that same faith himself.
So what caused him then to abandon his faith, or that kind of burgeoning faith, as an adolescent? Was he confronted? Was it more of a scientific inquiry, or was it thinking back on the death of his mom and how God abandoned him, or was there a specific incident?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and I would answer that like in many of our lives, it's a combination of factors, and I would also say it happened very gradually. Later on in Screwtape Letters, Lewis says that he kind of drew on his own ideas of what it meant to be tempted and lose your faith and stay close to God. And he drew on his own experience. People asked him, did you read a lot of theology books before you write Screwtape Letters? He says, no, I had a better something than that. What's that? He says, my own heart. I just looked in my own heart, my own experience. Mm-hmm. Anyway, in there, Screwtape tells his young nephew, who's got this patient he's working on, he says, now, be careful as you sort of draw him away from faith. He says, don't make it too obvious, because, you know, if he suddenly realizes, oh, my gosh, this is terrible, I'm on the wrong path, he might suddenly turn back. He said the gradual, soft slope that he can't tell that he's sort of falling away from faith. So Lewis had a number of things. Number one, I would say, is the lack of great spiritual direction. And you could say that Lewis's the rest of his life, why would he spend so many hours writing these books that we now know and love? Part of the reason is because when he was a young person, there was so little spiritual direction. Over and over he writes, if someone had pointed this out to me, or if someone had told me, and, you know, it's interesting. For as much guidance as we seem to give young people, there are a lot of young people who, like Lewis, had very little spiritual guidance. And so we fell into all sorts of kooky thinking, one of which was this nutty idea about prayer. And he felt like he had to work himself up into this proper emotional state where he was concentrating on prayer, and if he had one thought that wasn't quite right, then the whole night was ruined, and he began to dread his prayer life because he could never live up to that. And, you know, just think if he had a really great youth minister who had come and said, hey, Jack, you've got this all wrong. You need to talk to God like you're talking to a friend. You don't have to work yourself up into some sort of heightened emotional state. That was part of it. Another part of it was that the world became, you know, quite attractive to him, and the ease of living in the world, where you didn't have to abide by any strict, you know, principles as you do when you're a Christian. You know, we're called to quite a high standard. And then the third thing that he started to undermine his faith was he starts to read these other myths, and he says, you know, and it was clear that no one ever thought that the story of Loki or Thor, things that he would study in the original languages, or the Greek or Roman, no one thought those were true. And so all of a sudden he thought, well, you know, why should I believe that the Christian stories are true? And, of course, again, there's no one there with the book Mere Christianity put into his hands to say, well, here's some reasons you might think they're true. And so he gradually fell away from the faith there and didn't come back to it until he was in his 30s and a teacher at Oxford.
What was going on with C.S. Lewis professionally during this time? Was he already at Oxford in his 20s? Was he teaching elsewhere or writing? How was he making a living?
Well, he's got a kind of interesting story. We mentioned how dreadful the English schools were. And, you know, if you've read a couple of Dickens novels, you know he's not making up. I know today that there's a lot of young boys who say that their school is a concentration camp and that their principal is a madman. But in Lewis's case, it was a concentration camp, and one of his headmasters actually did go off to the loony bin right after Lewis left. So it was pretty terrible. He wasn't just making it up. There was a period where schools were not as nurturing as they are now. There's been lots of reforms. Anyway, he hates school. And he hates it not because he doesn't like to work. He hates it because he loves to learn. So he begs with his dad and finally convinces him to let him finish what we would call his high school years with a guy who had been his father's tutor, a guy named William Kirkpatrick. And this guy becomes memorialized as the professor in The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. And this guy teaches him logic, teaches him to think and write precisely. And, of course, we hear him echoed in that famous line that everyone knows from The Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe, logic. What do they teach at these schools? Logic, right? And so he drums that into Lewis, teaches him to think. And I'll tell you, in an amazing way, he didn't turn Lewis into an atheist. Lewis was an atheist by the time he went there at the age of 16. He was already a very serious atheist. What he did is train him. And interestingly enough, we have a very dedicated atheist, William Kirkpatrick, training a newfound atheist, C.S. Lewis, to think and write clearly and rigorously. And that training of one atheist to another was used in such great stead in all of Lewis's apologetic work. So God worked in various ways, doesn't he?
That is fascinating. Now, what is there?
So just quickly, after he gets tutored by Kirkpatrick, he gets into Oxford. He gets a degree in philosophy. And I'll just say this. Here's another lovely turning in his life. He gets a degree in philosophy. And, you know, he's a very serious atheist with a degree in Oxford from philosophy, so he knows his stuff. Anyway, he goes looking for a college job then. And back then, there was no master's or PhD. You got a degree, and it was the degree, and you went on and taught college. I mean, there's no opening. And here's the time where Lewis is not a Christian yet, but nevertheless, he thinks, oh, my gosh, there's no openings in philosophy. And he's applying everywhere, like humanities graduates today do. And he can't get a job. And he thinks it's the worst thing that could have happened to him. Oh, my gosh, he writes his dad. There's lots of letters. It's terrible. I can't get a job. So he decides to go back and, with his dad's financial support, gets a degree in English. Well, this thing that he thought was the worst thing that happened, not getting a job in philosophy, turns out to be what? The best thing that could have ever happened. He goes back. He studies English Lit. He finds he's much, much more suited to it. And after he graduates with his second degree, he gets a job at one of the colleges of Oxford, Magdalen College, and stays there for about 25 or 30 years teaching. And had he not gotten that job, that degree in English, we might never have, you know, the Chronicles of Narnia. We might never have the Space Trilogy. You know, this literary turn in his life was huge. Having said that, if he hadn't first got that philosophy degree, we might not have the Screwtape Letters. So, you know, things that God's working in all of our lives in ways that we may not detect until later in life. He goes to Oxford, and as an adult, he falls. All of his friends just happened. All the people he really likes and hangs out with just happen to be, well, Christians. And rather than him influencing them, you know, he has a degree in philosophy, it's they who end up influencing him. In his early 30s, he meets a then-unknown professor of Anglo-Saxon named J.R.R. Tolkien. They become great friends, and it's a lovely story. It's never been told on film yet. I hope someday it is. Tolkien becomes one of the key factors in bringing C.S. Lewis to belief in Christ.
Now, I'm assuming that at Oxford, given what you said, there was a vibrant, at least a small, vibrant evangelical community, Tolkien being one. Who were some of the others?
Yeah. I mean, and you're right to say it was small. I mean, surely your listeners know that in academia, committed Christians are kind of few and far between these days. And, of course, Oxford and Cambridge, like it, were sort of ahead of the pack in that even in the 1930s, Christianity was a rarity there. And so the fact that Lewis falls in with this small but committed group of Christians, people like J.R. Tolkien and then a guy named Hugo Dyson, who had done English, one of Lewis's best friend, Owen Barfield. Later on, Charles Williams will come up from London and join the Inklings. And this group of believers was great for turning out some of the greatest literature the century ever saw, and maybe any century ever saw.
Amazing. We're going to unpack a little more of what happened to Oxford, what happened to C.S. Lewis in Oxford in those days with our guest, Devin Brown. He is the author of this fascinating new book. It's called A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis. It's from Brazos Press, and if you'd like a copy of this book, we'd love to put you into a drawing. Give us a call right now, 877-93-FAITH. Give us your contact info. At the end of the hour, we will draw for three copies of A Life Observed. I'm Bill Meyer. This is the Faith Radio Network. Our website is myfaithradio.com. You can check out our entire broadcast schedule there. We'll take a quick break and be back with more with Devin Brown after this.
Here's what's ahead on the next Connecting Faith.
Single parents and blended families are becoming the norm, and moving from single to blended is not without its challenges. Ron Deal has been giving practical, biblical, encouraging advice to single parents for many years as the founder of Smart Step Families. On the next Connecting Faith, he'll join us to take on the topic of dating and the single parent and how blended families blend on the next Connecting Faith.
Listen for Connecting Faith weekdays at noon on Faith Radio.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Are you new to the station? Well, welcome. It's great to have you tuning in. We have a new listener packet that's designed for friends just like you. It tells you a little bit about the station, who we are, why we exist, and what we're hoping to accomplish in the Upper Midwest. It's yours free for the asking at myfaithradio.com. Check it out. It's myfaithradio.com. It's the new listener packet. Request yours today.
University of Northwestern, St. Paul, your life on purpose.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
Hey, welcome back. It is so great to have you with us today on this Saturday, a chilly Saturday in the Upper Midwest. I want to say hi to our friends who are listening in Sioux Falls on Faith 1270 and in Madison, Wisconsin on Faith 1190. We appreciate you tuning in today, and of course to all of our great friends here in Minnesota listening on Faith 900 in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And my guest this hour, Devin Brown. Devin is a fascinating guy. He teaches at Asbury University and has become an expert in the last several years on C.S. Lewis. He's written a new book called A Life Observed, A Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis. And, Devin, we were talking about Lewis's early days at Oxford. God brings into his life these committed evangelical Christians, J.R.R. Tolkien being one of them. Let's talk about that relationship for a moment and how, in effect, Tolkien helps to bring Jack, C.S. Lewis, to Christ.
Yeah, it's a story that's got some specific things, and it's got some universal things that I think everyone can relate to. Lewis calls his biography Surprised by Joy, and when he writes joy in that book, he always capitalizes with a J, and by that he means a special kind of feeling that he can't quite give a name to. He describes it as a special, deep kind of longing that kind of comes and goes. It kind of surprises him when it comes and then kind of goes. And he says, it's a longing like no other longing, because just having this longing was even better and more beautiful than having all sorts of other things fulfilled. And as an atheist, he's not just surprised by it. I would say he's shocked by it, because why should he have this longing that nothing in this world can seem to satisfy? And it's a longing that I would say haunts him, right? It's the hound of heaven sort of chasing after him no matter where he goes. And so later in life, you know, he writes in Mere Christianity, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is I was made for another world. That's what he finally concludes. So he's got this experience of joy, and he actually has a very deep commitment to truth. And, you know, if you go very far in philosophy these days, you find out that philosophers don't believe in three things that your average person believes in, and that wise people have believed in, you know, since the dawn of time, that there's such a thing as truth, there's such a thing as beauty, and there's such a thing as goodness. And so Lewis, as a philosopher, has been trained, no, those are all just constructs in your own mind. And he can't quite get his head around it. He can't quite believe it. And these things keep him seeking and searching. And there comes a point where he feels God is closing in on him. It's pretty interesting. He says, at one point, he sort of stops his story and says, you know, you think this is my search for God? And he says, yeah, it kind of is. But he says it could just as easily and maybe be more accurately described as God's search for me. And, you know, I think anybody can relate to that. We've all had this deep longing for something that this world can't quite satisfy, and we may try to fill that need and that desire with all sorts of stuff, but it won't be filled. You know, Augustine says we'll never find rest until we find rest in God. So that's Lewis's story to a T. And there's a famous passage from Surprised by Joy that you know, everybody quotes. He's he's alone in his rooms at Magdalen College in his 30s, and he's had these other believers influence him. He's had Christian writers. I mean, he happens to pick up a copy of G.K. Chesterton at one point and says, man, this guy can write. And then all of his favorite writers, George Herbert, John Donne, they're all just, well, happen to be Christian. He says, anyway, you must picture me alone in that night in Magdalen, in my rooms, feeling whenever my mind lifted the steady, unrelenting approach of him I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had last come upon me. In Trinity Term, 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God and knelt and prayed. And here's the great line. And perhaps that night, the most dejected and reluctant convert in all of England. I mean, he just wanted to be left alone. And God kind of closed in on him, and he decided, look, I could keep him out if I want to ignore him, but I have a choice. And he said, I loosened the rein. And that's a lovely, lovely phrase. I've thought about it a lot. Think of people who hold the reins tight on the horse they're riding and only let it go in a certain direction. And Lewis said, I decided to loosen the rein and let truth take me wherever it would. And once he did that, once he said, look, I'm not going to dictate where truth can go. I'm not going to say, well, it couldn't be that. Once he loosened the rein, truth would only take him to one place, and that's a belief in God.
Mm. And again, how did Tolkien play into this this spiritual journey and this conversion?
Yeah, so he and Lewis share this love of myth, right? Norse sagas, Icelandic sagas, Irish sagas, you name it, they loved it. And they used to, before there was the Inklings, the famous reading and writing group that Tolkien and Lewis read their own works to, there was the Kolbiters, and the Icelandic pronunciation is something like Kolbitar. And this is a group of people who used to huddle around the fire at Oxford, so close that the coals would bite their toes, and read these ancient Icelandic myths. They loved them. And Lewis, in particular, loved them because they stirred that longing for something beyond this world. Well, some of your listeners are going to go to Oxford someday if they haven't been there already, and they can go to Lewis's college, Magdalen College. They can see the building and those the windows of, you know, where he says, picture me in my rooms. You can stand right out there and picture him. Well, there's a lovely walk, a circular walk right next to Magdalen College called Addison's Walk, named after Joseph Addison, who was a professor there, you know, a century before Lewis or a couple centuries before. Anyway, Lewis and Tolkien and other Christian friends, Hugo Dyson, come over for dinner. And this is something college professors did all the time. Have dinner at my place, have dinner at your place. They didn't get paid very much, but they had really good food and you could invite guests. So they sit there in the dining hall at the high table and they have a lovely dinner. And then afterwards they go out for a walk, like they always love to do. They love to walk. And Addison's Walk is a lovely place. It's a warm September night, 1931. And they're walking around and round, and they get talking about faith. And Lewis, this was a big night for him. He describes it. It was warm and still. And he said, all of a sudden, the wind rustled the trees and blew up the leaves, and it just took our breath away and stopped him short in his path. And Tolkien, at that very moment, was talking to him. He says, now, Jack, you love this story of a dying God when you find it in myth, when you find it in Greek myths or Roman myths or Icelandic myths. He says, you love that story. It stirs you. But you just reject it when you find it in Christianity. And Lewis did. He's one of these people, and we meet him lots of times, who was predisposed, if it's Christian, don't want it, been there, done it, don't want to go back. They've got their blinders up. They've got their, you know, hands outstretched. Don't want it. Don't give it to me. He says, you like it every other time. He said, if you're having trouble accepting it, think of it as a myth, the kind you like, but one that became fact. And for Lewis, that's the key. That works for him. And it starts working on him, and he says, yes, I've been holding it out. It is the exact kind of story that stirs me. And why does it stir me? Because, well, there's something in me that wants the story. And all those other stories that are sort of, he calls them, splintered beams of light, God trying to speak through those other writers, this one is the true light coming through. And I'll just say this. I know people like to talk about how you become a Christian, and I've got some friends who think they've kind of got it down to five simple steps. And basically, we think other people are going to find Christ the same we did, and sometimes that's true. But Lewis has a pretty unique one. He says all these things have been working on me. And he says, my brother, his older brother, Warnie, and he were going to go to the zoo. And this is back, you know, in the 30s when gas isn't as plentiful. So his brother's got a motorcycle with a sidecar, something you don't see much anymore. And Lewis is going to ride in the sidecar and drive to Whipsnade Zoo, you know, 20 miles away. They get in the car, and he says, look, all I can tell you is I know when I got into that sidecar to go to the zoo with my brother, I didn't believe in God, Christ. And when I did, when I got there to that zoo, I did. That first step, he first comes to believe in God. And I think a lot of believers may have come to faith that way. They first make say, I don't believe in God, and then they come to believe in God. And then there's a second step to come to believe in Christ. So I don't know if anybody else who's been converted while riding in a sidecar, but Lewis has a great story.
I love it. Now, at this point, did C.S. Lewis immediately start to become an expert on apologetics and writing in this particular field? What was the first step for him? As obviously now we see him as this remarkable apologist. Was there a time of study, of more searching, or did he take all of his philosophy training and logic and start to tackle the defense of the faith at that point?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly wasn't overnight. You know, in 1931, we have that experience, the Addison's Walk and then the ride to Whipstead Zoo. And he'd written two books of poetry before as a young person, and, well, they were huge non-successes. Lewis first wanted to be one of these poets who came back from World War I, and there were a number of them who became quite famous. Well, he was not to be that. He was a failed poet. 2 years after his conversion to Christianity, he writes the first of his Christian works. It's a book called The Pilgrim's Regress. It's this sort of like The Pilgrim's Progress that people know, the John Bunyan work. It's an allegory, and while Lewis seemed to like allegory and that kind of literary thing, modern taste for allegory has all but disappeared. And if he had not gone on to write better works, we might not be having this discussion today. But that was a start, The Pilgrim's Regress. And it led to him writing The Problem of Pain in 1940, so that's 9 years later. And The Problem of Pain led to him writing lots of other things, The Screwtape Letters, The Great Divorce, speaking on the BBC. So it wasn't an overnight thing. It was something that happened over the next decade. And then had a couple periods in the next 20 years where things sort of exploded and died down. I'll tell you this, most people today know him as writing The Chronicles of Narnia. But for a while, you know, The Chronicles of Narnia did not appear until the 50s. In the 40s, he wrote The Screwtape Letters, came out in 42. And in 1947, he's on the cover of Time magazine. And if anybody's ever seen that picture, there's this little devil on one shoulder and an angel's wing over the other. And he's on the cover of Time magazine long before he even envisioned the idea of The Chronicles of Narnia. He's on for The Screwtape Letters.
Wow.
And he writes a friend. He says, I'm going to be, if I live long enough, one of those men who was a famous writer in his 40s and dies unknown. Well, what God had planned for him.
Oh. Now, so it sounds like at that time, the Screwtape Letters was a worldwide phenomenon if he was in the cover of Time magazine.
Yes, it was, as they say in the business, his breakout book. He'd done Problem of Pain. He does Great Divorce. But no, Screwtape Letters is what put him on the map. And he becomes a big success in Great Britain and a huge success in the United States.
Does it go to the stage right away, or is it several years before it becomes a play?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it was a book for the longest time, and it's only recently, after Lewis dies in 63, 50 years ago, it's only recently that there's been a stage version of it. And, you know, they talk about making it into a movie, but as they say, it's devilishly hard to adapt to the big screen. It's been adapted well to the stage. I know lots of people have seen the Max McLean adaptation, and it's really wonderful. But they've yet to figure out, they still don't have a script they're happy with, so we'll see.
Amazing. We are talking to Devin Brown. He is the author of this great new book on C.S. Lewis, his life and his faith. It's called A Life Observed, a Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis. And we do have three copies of the book to give away. If you would like one of those, give us a call and we'll put you into a drawing at the end of the hour. We'll give away three copies. The number is 877-93-FAITH. It's 1144. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Bill Meyer, back with a final segment with our guest Devin Brown after this quick break.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. Thank you for your friendship and your partnership with this ministry. Each day, we're able to provide family-focused teaching and relevant Bible preaching because of the generosity of friends just like you. Recently, we had a call from one of our listeners who said, as I called in to renew my pledge this morning, I thanked God for what you were doing in our area across the United States and even around the world. You are truly doing amazing things for Christ, and we are happy to continue to support Changed Lives. We do thank this dear friend for their generous support, and you too, because together we are making a difference for Christ all across the upper Midwest and around the world via the internet. Thank you for your generous support this month. If you're not already a member of our monthly support team, would you consider joining? You can do that simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com. Thank you again for standing with Faith Radio.
On the next Everyday Relationships.
You do your best to raise your son, but he's still acting out. You and your spouse agreed on a budget, but you can't resist the call of the mall. Your mother-in-law said that one thing again, and your spouse stood idly by again. You know what? Life is messy, but we're here to help you when you call in with your questions at 855-2-RELATE.
Everyday Relationships. Real life, real talk. Weekdays at 4 on Faith Radio. Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. If you'd like to touch base with us by phone, the number is 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH, our website, myfaithradio.com. We're diving into the life and the faith of C.S. Lewis today, talking to Devin Brown, the author of A Life Observed, a spiritual biography of C.S. Lewis. Devin, one of the things that really impacted C.S. Lewis we haven't talked much about is war. He actually served in the British Army during World War I and was wounded, and then, as we know, did a series of marvelous radio broadcasts during World War II. Talk about how, first of all, how World War I impacted him, and then what he did in Great Britain on the BBC in World War II.
Like, you know, young men today, he actually did not have to enlist. He would not have been drafted. He's from Northern Ireland, but he did enlist and went to France and got wounded. And it was not a good time. He didn't speak much about it because it was just terrible. And a lot of people got home and were thankful they made it home, mostly in one piece, and he was one of those. When World War II broke out, he wrote a friend that how it terrified him. The thought of going to war again was just was horrible, even for him, and he's now a Christian. He gets invited by the religious editor at the BBC to give a series of talks. And, you know, let's just be honest, this is something the BBC would not do. They would not want a prominent Christian to give these talks again. It's not something they see as their duty. But anyway, this is a time when, and you know, the Blitz on London, the bombs are falling like black rain, and, you know, every night the air raid sirens go off, the searchlight goes on, and they turn to Lewis to articulate some of the timeless truths that people, that Christians at all times have believed, and they're incredibly successful. People are listening to him. They ask for a second series, a third series, a fourth series. Later, a decade later, they get bound into the book Mere Christianity, and that's what we have today. And that book is so effective because Lewis knew that he was speaking to people who desperately needed hope, needed reason to believe in a world that seemed like it had gone crazy, and just ordinary folk. And so that's what became Mere Christianity for us.
It's so fascinating because you think of the BBC today and the spiritual climate of Great Britain today, and you certainly wouldn't see an apologist being offered an opportunity to speak to the people. What was the spiritual climate of England in those days? You have the Church of England, which I'm assuming was, for the most part, fairly dead, ritualistic. Was there some kind of a vibrant faith movement within that church, or was it outside of that church? And how did C.S. Lewis play into the greater Christian experience in Britain?
Yeah, I mean, I got to tell you, an American trying to figure out the Church of England thing, where their queen is actually the head of their church, and they have a state church, it's very hard for, I think, most Americans to even figure out what that means. One thing for sure it means is a lot of nominalism. If you have a state church that everyone, quote-unquote, can belong to, whether they really want to or not, there's a fair bit of people for whom going to church is a social thing. It's where you get married and buried. I find it hard to say exactly what things were like for the average person in the 40s. My guess is, you know, if you go to England today and go to one of these great cathedrals, you know, they'll have evening song, they'll have church on Sunday like we do here, there'll be very few people who go, or very few British people who will go. Let's say that. There's a lot of tourists who will be there. But my sense is in the 40s it wasn't quite that way. And of course, Lewis, when he spoke, you know, there's a lot of non-Church of England people. There's a lot of Protestants and Baptists and Catholics. And so there's a lot of other denominations. And Lewis's talks, as we know from the title, Mere Christianity, are the kind of talks that any Christian would find uplifting. So he was an inspiration to all believers at the time. And I suspect, as he's done today, I mean, he's got this weird ability to both help serious believers mature and also at the very same time speak to people who haven't come to faith yet. I mean, usually that you do one or the other, right? You either evangelize non-Christians or you help disciple mature Christians. And oddly enough, a book like Mere Christianity seems to be able to do both.
Was there any criticism of the BBC or of Lewis for those broadcasts, or was it pretty much universally accepted in Britain as this is what was needed during this time of crisis, during the war, and this time of great fear during the Blitz?
Well, I'll tell you what, you'll be surprised. The one criticism of Lewis came not from people who were secular, but from people who were serious theologians, right? And, you know, Lewis tried to just let that kind of criticism run off him, but the idea that here's this layman who's speaking to ordinary people about matters of faith, well, shouldn't they have a professional theologian? And at one point, I think he must have got tired of people complaining that he, you know, didn't have, you know, the right degrees to do this. He said, look, if the theologians of my day had been able to speak in ordinary words that ordinary people could have understood, I wouldn't have had to do that. But for the most part, they didn't. And so he got criticized from that side. The other side he gets criticized from is no surprise. The serious academics at Oxford looked at him doing these kinds of things and then going on to write the Chronicles of Narnia. And they thought, well, this is not something he should be doing. Now, if he had neglected his academic work, that would have been one thing. And I understand that. If you're hired to be a scholar and you don't do scholarship in your own field but do this other kind of work, well, then you haven't lived up to your bargain. But Lewis was an outstanding scholar. His lectures were the highest attended in Oxford. His Oxford output was recognized all around the world as being serious. He was asked to write one of the volumes of the Oxford University's History of English Language and Literature, and it became the most popular one after it. So it's not that he lacked it, but they didn't like him doing this other stuff. So in the British system of university, you're hired as a don or a fellow or a tutor, and then when one of these chairs opens up, a professor's chair, which, as Lewis said later, slightly less work for slightly more pay, he was passed over twice for it. And the thinking is it's not because he lacked the output, it was because there was, you know, pushback against his Christian writing.
Interesting. We've just got about 5 minutes left, Devin. Let's talk about Joy Davidman and his relationship with her. He's this longtime bachelor, married later in life, and how that impacted the life of C.S. Lewis.
Yeah, the last two things, the last decade that every, and what many people know him for today, are in the 1950s, he meets a Christian divorcee, a convert from Judaism and from atheism and communism, Joy Gresham. And that story is the one that's told in the film Shadowlands to some extent, the Anthony Hopkins, Deborah Winger movie. Of course, the other thing he does in his 50s is write the Chronicles of Narnia. And that's why a lot of people know him today, too. And there's lots to be said about that. His time with Joy Davidman is interesting. She comes over and she's fleeing an abusive husband, a bad marriage, an alcoholic husband, and so she brings her two boys to come and live in England where it's much cheaper. It's the exact opposite. If you go to there today, it's way more expensive than the States. Back then, it was way cheaper right after the war, and so she comes over to live, and at one point, she's going to be deported. Her visa runs out, and the Home Office won't let her renew it. Lewis marries her in a civil ceremony, people may know the story, just to allow her to extend his citizenship to her and her two sons. They're allowed to stay. They have become friends at this point and become better and better friends. Then there's an amazing day where she falls and she breaks her hip, and it turns out she's got cancer, and it's terrible, and she's in the hospital for months, and they think she's going to die. And the one thing that she really wants is to be married before the eyes of God, and she and Jack have become romantically as in love as anybody ever could be. So on her what they think is her deathbed or by her hospital bed, Lewis invites one of his former students, Peter Bide, to come in and marry them before the eyes of God. And while he's there, he prays for her healing. She's sent home to die, and in one of the greatest stories you'll ever hear, she doesn't die. She gets better and better and better. They have three incredible years together. They go to Greece. They go to Ireland. And then, of course, the cancer comes back, and she passes away. Lewis, who's a believer and does not lose his faith but suffers grief, decides to write about it because he's having, you know, like Christians would, any Christian would, trouble with it. He writes A Grief Observed. And if your listeners haven't read that yet and they're looking for a book that really presents grief in all its brutal fury and works through it, it's a lovely book. People have read it, you know, since then. He writes that book and gradually works his way past that grief and finds healing and wholeness again.
Mm. It's a beautiful. It was the movie of that relationship true to form, or were there some liberties taken with it?
It's based on a true story, as they say. I would say Deborah Winger's depiction of Joy Gresham is quite accurate. Anthony Hopkins plays Lewis as this guy who was kind of closed and locked away in an ivory tower and didn't really experience much of life until she showed up. And, you know, that's way not true. Lewis had lost his mother. He'd been in the war. He'd known lots of great friends and great ups and downs. So he had lived life. He wasn't that sort of nerdy academic that Joy Gresham then had to save. But the parts about the grief are quite accurate, quite telling.
Hmm. Now, Doug Gresham, his stepson, has gone on to be involved. And in fact, he endorsed your book with a wonderful endorsement. We just got about 2 minutes left. Tell us about Douglas.
Yeah, so I'll just say he's a great guy and has his own great story. So, yeah, I mentioned that he and his brother come over, leaving this terrible family life with their dad. And picture this. His mom dies in 1960. His birth dad dies a couple years later. And then C.S. Lewis dies in 1963. Doug Gresham follows Lewis's casket, the family member that's leading the mourners. At age 18, he's lost his mother, his father, and now his stepfather. As you might guess, he wants to get as far from Lewis, Christianity, England as he can. He goes to Australia, which is about the other side of the world. And he has his own lovely, incredible story of his return to faith and his calling to ministry in Ireland. And then, of course, now he's very involved with the Lewis estate. He was the executive producer on the first three Narnia films. And if people follow these things, he's recently announced that they're on track to make The Silver Chair, which is the fourth book in the series, in, I'm thinking, 2017 is the number I'm hearing. So not too long.
Hmm. Well, Devin, this has just been a fascinating hour. We appreciate you so much, your commitment to scholarship and to just telling this beautiful story of C.S. Lewis. Once again, The Life Observed is the name of the book, A Life Observed, a Spiritual Biography of C.S. Lewis from Brazos Press. Devin, thank you for your time. May God continue to guide you and direct you in your teaching there at Asbury. And we appreciate you so much in being our guest today on Faith Radio.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Devin Brown, and we thank you for joining us here on the Faith Radio Network. Join us on next Saturday at 11 a.m. And meanwhile, let me encourage you to tune in to my good friend Neil Stavem and his program Connecting Faith on Monday as he interviews one of my friends, Ron Deal, probably one of the top step family experts in the country from a Christian perspective, as he gets into dating and the single parent and how blended families blend. That's coming up on Monday on Connecting Faith with Neil Stavem. You can find our entire broadcast schedule at myfaithradio.com. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll be